Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have as our guest someone we've been trying to get for a long time. We finally got on the air, someone who rarely does interviews. We are going to have as our guest noted author, essayist, poet, novelist, Ishmael Reed, joining us to talk about the media and politics and what's going on in the United States today. It's going to be a wonderful show, so I hope you'll enjoy it. But first, before we go to our guest, Ishmael Reed, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. The auction of prime blocks of wireless airwaves ended last week, bringing in $19.6 billion. Congress and the FCC had hoped that the auction would bring competition to the wireless market and provide a new wireless competitor to the cable and phone companies. But incumbents Verizon and AT&T were the big winners of the auction, virtually ensuring that there will be no meaningful competition in the wireless field for a long time to come. Harold Feld, Senior Vice President of the Media Access Project, says that the auction was a success in some ways. It brought in a lot of revenue. And new rules for the portion of open access spectrum will allow consumers to use any legal phone or device on the network, proving that an open network is an attractive business model. But, Feld says, the auction failed to produce an alternative wireless broadband provider. He says auctions are clearly not the way to bring competition to telecommunications.
If we're going to use auctions, I think we had the best rules possible. But the plain fact is that you can't expect auctions to repeal the basic laws of capitalism. If we are going to say that those who value the thing the most or can extract the most value from it and who can spend the most money for it deserve to have it, which is how we do this by auction, then we must resign ourselves that the same people are going to get it again and again.
Incumbents have a great advantage, Feld says, because they already have their networks and customers. Google, which was also bidding for the open access spectrum, estimated that it would take another $12 billion on top of the $4.6 billion winning bid to begin a new network.
So really, the only way that you can use auctions to bring in new competition is if you make the current incumbents sit the auction out.
Feld says we'll need to look at regulating the wireless operators in a way that will open the platform and control the worst anti-consumer practices.
And that means getting rid of early termination fees. That means truth in billing. It means looking at some kind of open device condition for all wireless services and just biting the bullet and saying, well, we didn't keep these guys out, so now we have to live in a world where we only have a couple of people who are offering service.
On August 2nd, Chauncey Bailey, an investigative reporter and editor of the Oakland Post, was shot and killed on his way to work. Bailey had been working on a story regarding the suspicious financial activity of an Oakland business called Your Black Muslim Bakery at the time of his murder. A 19-year-old California man who worked at the bakery has been charged with the murder, but many questions surrounding his motives remain unanswered. After Bailey's death, New America Media and the Maynard Institute for Journalism Education pulled together a group of more than two dozen reporters, photographers, and editors to continue and expand on the reporting Bailey was pursuing when he was killed. Robert Rosenthal is the executive director of the Center for Investigative Reporting and executive editor of the Chauncey Bailey Project.
We're not only looking at Chauncey's death, which we still believe there's a story to be told about truly why he was killed and who killed him, but also looking at all the issues and institutions and societal pressures that have created the environment where a journalist could be gunned down in Oakland. So it's not just ripples, but waves going out from his death. We keep peeling back the layers of this very big onion.
Rosenthal said that bringing reporters together who were actual competitors in the news business was difficult at first.
Over time, it really grew much more collaborative, and the results are very clear that we've done a lot of fine work.
The project continues to uncover stories, including a double homicide in 1968 that has been traced back to the bakery. And just this week, the Chauncey Bailey Project was given an award by the investigative reporters and editors for its extreme dedication to get at the truth.
Chauncey was a terrific community journalist. He was a personality in Oakland, especially in the black community. It was a real loss, and people knew him. I think the stories, hopefully, as we keep going, we'll look at greater issues in terms of government, delivery of services, even in Oakland, because they all revolve around it, and potentially the police and how they do their jobs in Oakland. And I think if we're successful by the end, we will have an impact, not only in trying to make sure that when journalists are killed in this country, people remember that other journalists will step in and, in a sense, defend them and make sure that there's justice, but also the ripple effect of Chauncey's work in terms of really making a difference to the people of Oakland.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, March 30th, 2008. Today we're very privileged to have on Media Matters as our guest one of the most accomplished writers of the past four decades in the United States. Our guest has written several novels, several collections of poetry, won countless awards, and is, among other things, a wonderful political essayist. It is my great honor to welcome to Media Matters Ishmael Reed. Mr. Reed?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. It is an honor indeed to have you with us. And among other things you do, you're a jazz pianist, I notice.
Yeah, we produced our first CD with a guest appearance by David Murray, the great tenor saxophonist. It includes Carla Blank playing on violin, Roger Glenn on flute, and Chris Planus playing the guitar.
Well, that's quite enough. I just been reading about you. You've just turned 70 and you have your first CD out, so...
Yeah, I began studying jazz when I was 60 years old, as a matter of fact. And I've studied for 10 years, first at the jazz school in Berkeley under Susan Mozzarella. And I've continued my studies with great jazz pianist Mary Watkins.
Did you just start playing piano at 60?
Yeah.
Wow. That's very impressive, I may say so.
Well, I think nowadays, if you retire, I hadn't retired at the age of 60, but... A lot of people retire at 55. You have about 40, maybe 40, 50 more years left.
I hope I'm that lucky.
So, why not? I think people in the future are going to be able to go through a number of careers.
And one of your other part of your portfolio is you're the editor and I think founder, if I'm not mistaken, of Conch Magazine. Is that correct?
I'm the publisher.
Publisher.
Ishmael Reed, P-U-B, one word, Ishmael Reed, P-U-B, short for publisher.com.
And what is Conch, and what will people find if they go to that site to look it up?
Well, we have correspondents all over the world. As a matter of fact, when the riots in France broke out, we had about seven or eight French intellectuals and writers in conversation, which we reprinted on our zine about, the causes of the riots, going back to the occupation of Algeria. Over here, David Brooks says it was all the result of gangster rap. So, we're able to get a thorough analysis using cyberspace. I toured the Middle East a few years ago, and when I returned, I printed poetry and fiction by... students in Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, and other places. So we have I think with cyberspace, you have pretty much your reach is unlimited. Now, when I had a print version of this zine, I had to go around the country lugging copies of the magazine, and that was, really difficult for me. But now with cyberspace, I'm able to cut my costs and reach a huge audience.
And your experience in publishing goes back a long way. If I'm not mistaken, you were one of the co-founders of the legendary East Village Other back in the 1960s?
Well, Walter Bord, the late Walter Bord and I founded the East Village Other. I gave it its name after reading Carl Jung's Introduction to Paradise Lost. That's the kind of stuff we were doing down there. Those are the kind of books we were reading down in East Village when we were in our 20s. Walter Bord was a painter, and he was a bartender at a place called Stanley's, which was now become a very famous, legendary site for a lot of, novelists, a lot of novelists and painters and actors and playwrights, poets used to go to Stanley's, hang out in Stanley's. And he was working at the bar, and I asked him to do a mock-up for a paper I had in Newark, and he decided, you know, he could do a paper there in East Village, and so we collaborated. And, you know, we had artists and poets, like the late Alan Katzman, who was a New York poet, writing articles. They became journalists. So it was one of the first underground newspapers. As a matter of fact, some people say it was the first. There's a recording called The East Village Other. It's still online at Amazon. In the 60s, we all did this recording, and it includes the Velvet Underground, Ed Sanders, and, you know, the whole crew. I'm mm-hmm. on there, too.
And you are doing media criticism today, which is one of the primary reasons I want to have in our show, which is a show about the media, about the press and journalism. Mm-hmm. And I've been reading your press criticism for some time. I see that you are putting together a book, is that correct, of your media commentary?
The title of the book is called Mixing It Up. Mixing It Up, Taking on the Media Bullies. And it'll be out this year from DiCapo.
Well, I've been enjoying your writings a great deal, which is why I urged our producer to try to get you on the show, and I'm delighted you're joining us. For those who have not read Ishmael Reed, it is a real pleasure. And I think what was most striking to me is I read your political commentary and your media analysis was your sense of humor, the wit. More than once, my wife had to sort of say, "What are you laughing at?" was I was reading your work. And when you read it, because it's such powerful criticism, to mix it with humor, as you do, is unusual.
Thank you very much.
And very rare. And let's get right into your media criticism, because I think it's a voice that is not widely heard or spread in the, you know, certainly the media themselves. What is, for starting point, what's your overall assessment of the U.S. Commercial news media?
Well, I think it's about 50 years behind the South. It's one of the most segregated institutions existing in the country today, and perhaps that's the reason they can't assess this Barack Obama candidacy, because they were totally unprepared for a new generation of post-race intellectuals, which Barack Obama represents. They're used to The Wire, you know, where African Americans are presented as gangbangers and just, you know, irresponsible, degraded human beings, or they're used to hip hop. You know, my friend Stanley Crouch writes articles, columns critical of hip hop, and Bob Herbert weighs in once in a while, you know, criticizing hip hop. But their newspapers devote whole sections to hip hop. I mean, if you pick up the Times today, you'll see lots of space devoted to hip hop. So they're in conflict with their salespersons, the salespersons at the newspapers they work for, because they feel they can excite the younger demographic by, peddling the hip-hop. So that's the kind of image that they've given to American viewers and listeners and readers. And so that's why, you know, people are sort of in shock that all of a sudden a African-American candidate for the presidency emerges. But this generation has been predicted for about 20 years. As a matter of fact, Trey Ellis, who now has a spot at Huffington Post,
mm-hmm.
he's a young novelist and screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a manifesto, I think in the early 80s or late 70s, saying that his generation was not hung up on race like mine, you know, that we were bitter and... their generation was one that was going to put race in the background. And this is kind of talk that came out of Harvard University, African-American Studies Department, that the problems of the poor were self-inflicted or structural or behavioral. So this generation has been on the way. But the media have not prepared the public for this generation, because they've been hung up on the old cliches that they've been dissing African-Americans for 100 years or so, showing them as criminal elements and rapists and all kinds of stuff like that. You know, nothing's changed since D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation. As a matter of fact, I've seen movies that are worse.
Well, you know, I'm laughing now. Obviously, I'm not laughing at what you're saying, because it's anything but funny. But one of the terms you coined that you use in your writing is called blackaholic.
Yeah.
And what could you explain to our listeners what you mean by black?
Well, I think that it's pretty obvious that the corporate media represented by MSNBC and CNN, view, you know, pushing race, the so-called wedge, as a way of raising revenue. I mean, if it had not been for the O.J. trial, CNN would have tanked. If it had not been for O.J., Geraldo Rivera would have gone out of business. So they saw, as a matter of fact, New York Times had articles when CNN was suffering a slump saying, calling on O.J., you know, because that's sort of like, that was a big hit. That was bigger than Roots and all the other television spectaculars. That trial went on a year. So they figured that, wow, they found that there's a big market in pushing the racial divide. So that's why they're pushing the racial divide more than they are the gender divide and other fault lines in American life. So it's a big money-making thing for the corporate media.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Ishmael Reed, the novelist, playwright, and now jazz pianist. Also media critic of a forthcoming book, has been writing widely. You can find his work on media all over the internet. Just Google his name. I suspect it'll be coming up. And if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Ishmael Reed, our telephone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Mr. Reed, at the beginning, just now you were talking about sort of a post-race generation, and it sounded like you had mixed feelings toward this construction, insofar as it might also be sort of a post-inequality generation. Are you surprised yourself at the degree to which people under the age of 29, in really stunning numbers, have supported Obama in the primary so far?
Well, I'm not too surprised. I mean, we've been through this before. Eldridge Cleaver commented that the 1960s generation of whites could dance better. But a lot of these people became neoconservatives, you know, and as a matter of fact, members of the far right, like David Horowitz, who used to be, you know, like a white panther, you know, used to be working with the Black Panthers out here.
Mm-hmm.
So it remains to be seen whether this is a changing point in American politics and history and culture, or whether it's just a temporary thing. But, I mean, I'm delighted to see it. I think that, Obama's, as a matter of fact, there's studies show that children of biracial couples are able to mediate problems between blacks and whites.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, there's a study. There's a study that shows that they're somewhere in between and they can assess the attitudes of both. They can sympathize with both groups. So Obama fits this picture. And there are a lot of, the fastest growing group in California is biracial children. And, I mean, when I look at Teller, I don't know for whom to root. some of these guys on Sacramento basketball team, or I look at Jason Kidd, you don't know where these people are coming from. So this is something that's new and something that's growing. Of course, most African Americans have a biracial ancestry, but that's not explored in the public forum because it's harder to talk about that than talk about race, as a matter of fact. It's harder to talk about race mixing. For example, I'm looking at Pat Buchanan and other Irish-American commentators on MSNBC predicting that Obama will not get the so-called working class or Reagan Democrat vote in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Maureen Dowd pulled a mask off this whiteness and said these people are Irish. Well, Obama's mother's Irish. So I mean, if a drop of black blood makes him black, why doesn't a drop of Irish blood make him Irish? And why don't his fellow Irish persons support his candidacies, which they do, as a matter of fact. That's another example of how the media create, the corporate media create a wedge in order to make money. I got a note from Dan Cassidy, the author of How the Irish Invented Slang, a book I recommend that all your listeners get a hold of, also published by Counterpunch. And he reminded me that there are a lot of Irish who are supporting Obama, like Casey and Kennedy's, Caroline and Teddy Kennedy and others, and Kerry, and he mentioned the author, William Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's quite possible that Obama's received hundreds of thousands of votes from Irish Americans already. So, but here goes the media. When they went to South Carolina, they tried to pit white against black. When they moved west, it was Latinos against blacks. And this is an example of how different points of view are left out of the media. The Latino journalists, like there's a Rodriguez at Time Magazine, Ruben Navarrete at the San Francisco Chronicle, and others said this is not true. That, and they pointed out examples where Latinos have been supported very heavily by, black candidates have been supported very heavily by Latino voters. For example, David Dinkins got 85% of the Latino vote. Barack Obama got 44% Latino vote in Arizona. So when they say that, there's a wedge, sometimes it doesn't exist, and they do it to make money. That's why you hear more about Reverend Wright than all of the evangelists who are linked to John McCain and to Hillary Clinton.
Our guest today, Ishmael Reed. You're listening to Media Matters. This is WILL AM 580 coming to you from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our phone number, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Ishmael Reed is a noted and award-winning novelist, essayist, poet, and now jazz musician. He is talking about his commentary and analysis of media and politics in the United States today and life in America today. We welcome your phone calls, and let's go to the phone lines right now for our first caller. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Ishmael Reed.
Yes, sir. You kind of stole my thunder, Mr. Reed, but because I was going to ask you how the media, MSNBC, CNN, and to some degree the major networks, but especially those two cable outlets, have used Reverend Jeremiah Wright vis-a-vis Senator Obama as a way to build a racial wedge. And I think in hopes, maybe subliminally, but I think consciously, of derailing the candidacy of Senator Obama. Could you respond to that?
Yeah, sure. I think that that's a good point. I think that, I think, first of all, they're intimidated by the Clintonistas, who are claiming that they're being treated unfairly by the media. But if you recall, after Hillary Clinton broke down in tears or became tearful before the New Hampshire vote.
Yeah, just before the New Hampshire primary.
They ran that thing all day, that night. It was a loop. They ran it constantly, and I think that contributed to her victory. And then, before Texas, the same thing happened, that 3 a.m. ad that they put out to instill fear in the Texas voters, black crime or whatever, because I have certainly interpreted that ad as sort of like a Willie Horton ad. They ran that all. They gave her free advertising. So that's not true that they're favorable to her. But I think your caller has it right, is that I don't think that they're trying to get Hillary Clinton elected. I think what they're doing is they're trying to make money.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to make money. They show Reverend Wright as some kind of terrorist and anti-American when the guy's a Marine. You know what, you have all these multi-deferment chicken hawks on television, calling him anti-American, when some of the evangelists who are linked to John McCain have said things that I consider to be worse. Hillary Clinton was embraced by Billy Graham. As a matter of fact, she called him her spiritual advisor and the one who really consoled her during the Monica Lewinsky episode. And Billy Graham is on record for saying some terrible things about different groups.
Ishmael Reed, also, you've written about, I think, the Geraldine Ferraro comment, basically to the effect that Obama has only gotten this far because of the benefits of being an African-American male. Otherwise, his candidacy would be not a serious candidacy. What did you make of that?
Well, I was shocked because I think among white ethnic groups, none has been smeared as much as the Italian-American group. Out here in California during World War II, there was an incarceration of Italian Americans who were considered disloyal, And as a matter of fact, there's a good book on that by called The Forgotten Interment. That book talks about how Italian American immigrants were sent to camps out here, and how the movement of Italian Americans who were born here were restricted in places like Stockton, California. They're satirized or they're ridiculed. The image of Italian Americans is that of the Godfather or a movie that Italian American civil rights groups hated. Also, The Sopranos. So it's just amazing that someone who belongs to a group that's been smeared that way would use, you know, the oldest of stereotypes, that the only reason that Barack Obama got where he is was because of he's a black man. And, of course, you know, he replied. I mean, his replies are just very clever. Reminds very much of John F. Kennedy. His sort of like rebuttals.
How so?
Said that, you know, he said that he's an African American with a name called, you know, Barack Obama. And he said the fact that he has an advantage is a view that's not widely shared. I thought that was so cool. You know? So I think this is the kind of stuff when you get into racial politics. And I think the media just inflames this stuff. He tried to give her a break. You know, he tried to say that, well, you know, she's being unfairly criticized. And then she came back again, you know, and said, well, you know, he's black. So, I mean, this is the kind of stuff when you get news outlets that are more interested in entertainment than really informing the public. And I was thinking the other day, you know, what would happen if Edward R. Murrow went on Dancing with the Stars? I mean, could you imagine that?
No, I couldn't.
You know, Edward R. Murrow going on doing a Froog or something. It's so ridiculous. These guys are entertainers. They're not serious.
Well, as a result of the whole right flap, finally Obama made a speech, a talk, was it a week ago now, or I lose track of time, a week and a half ago, on the issue of race in his campaign. What did you make of that speech?
Well, I thought he was pandering when he talked about white resentment. I mean, affirmative action is not a black program. Those who benefit the most from affirmative action are white women. Out here in California, white women members of the faculty of the University of California have complained that their numbers on the faculty have dwindled because of Proposition 209. Patricia Island, Jesse Jackson, Rabbi Michael Lerner, writing in Time Magazine, Seymour Lipset, in a book called Broken Alliance, all quoted as saying that affirmative action has benefited white women the most. So when he sort of stereotypes, but this is a tough love generation. I mean, he goes before black audiences, makes tough love speeches, and I don't think, you know, to be frank, I don't think there's any group on the planet that's been subsidized as much as many white Americans. I mean, while African Americans were slaves and while Native Americans were being driven off their land, you know, white Americans who were lucky enough in that time were able to get free land. The Great Society programs, which are stereotyped as a black program, or the War on Poverty, two-thirds of those who benefited from the War on Poverty were white Americans. Those who benefit the most from the Great Society programs, Medicare, Medicaid, 80% white Americans. I mean, a number of programs like affirmative action that are stereotyped as benefiting blacks benefit whites. And so like many of the small business loans that were set aside for African Americans were taken over by white companies, which use black people as a front. So, you know, when he talks about personal responsibility and preaches exclusively to black audiences, well, we could all use some personal responsibility. I mean, the thousands of whites who are hooked on amphetamine, which is like a one-day or two-day story at the Times, where mm-hmm. blacks are dogged all the time, they could use some personal responsibility. These are people who are abandoning their children. So we could all use that, not just blacks. So, I mean, that's all from this tough love or post-race generation. They believe that racism is something that's a thing of the past. I mean, Obama said that the reaction to Katrina had nothing to do with the race and the Gina 6 down there in, was it Texas?
Louisiana also.
Yeah, had nothing to do with race. So I just disagree with this generation. And I might even count my daughter. I mean, she's 31, and She's had a very good education. She's gone to private schools, and so she sees the world differently from the way I see it.
Ishmael Reed, our guest today on Media Matters. We're talking about media coverage and politics. And I think one of the themes that really comes through, that you just alluded to right now, Mr. Reed, that comes through in a lot of your writings on media, is that not just African-Americans, not just black people, but especially black men are sort of get the short end of the stick in our news media and our media culture writ large.
Yeah, well, you know, I had a kid. I live in a ghetto here. Yeah, we had our latest shootout last week, you know, on the block here. Not to say that that's typical of ghetto life, but I had a kid come over here to the house asking me to help him with his science homework. The black kid, and I told him that I'd read a book called Black Women Scientists, and in that book I discovered that the person who was responsible for creating a formula for sending a shuttle into space and having it return safely to the Earth was a black woman, that there are a number of NASA scientists who are African Americans. As a matter of fact, I met some of them when I went down to talk to the black employees at Lockheed Martin, engineers and scientists, and that the two leading astronomers in Philadelphia and in New York are African Americans. So African Americans feel that we don't get as much. We're not presented with as much variety in the corporate media as does not reflect the variety of African American life in the corporate media. And I think cyberspace is given it will become the equalizer. I mean, there are a number of blogs and the number of African American websites where you get a different story.
Our guest, Ishmael Reed is our guest. Let's go back to the phone lines now. If you'd like to call in, the number here, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. This is Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. We welcome your calls. Just a reminder, next week we will have a two-hour version of Media Matters. It's our pledge drive show, lots of goodies, and John Nichols will be joining us to talk politics for 2 hours. So please be sure to tune in then. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's go right now to line two, Champaign County. You're on the air with Ishmael Reed.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'll be quick because I'm actually rushing off to a jazz vocal recital in the hall. And
I wish I could join you.
Hallow Halls. Yeah, it should be great. I wanted to highlight that it's not just Billy Graham. Barbara Ehrenreich, Good Feminist Credentials in the Latest Nation, has an article about Hillary Clinton's ties to this group called the Family, or variously the Fellowship, that seems to go back to the Pinochet days when they were supporting that. It's a very odd thing. I think there's a full-length book coming out to chronicle it. So that's, I was shocked even, and I'm not so shockable, I think. But I wanted you to react to something else that's happening in academia here that some people are skeptical of. There's a conference coming up here called Rupture, Repression, Uprising, and it's inviting interesting people talking about various rebellions, mainly by African Americans, but not restricted to that, in various times, Bacon's Rebellion, I don't know, lots of things like that. But one, Anglo gentleman, the guy that wrote Lies My Teacher Taught Me is here.
Oh, yeah, James Lowen.
His latest book is called Sundown Towns, which...
Right, great book.
Which chronicles that there were 568 towns in Illinois alone that were African Americans had to be out of town by dusk.
Yep.
And that's history, but there's a town south of here that had a horn that went off, and it was only turned off about 10 years ago. That was supposed to be the signal for African Americans to finish their jobs or finish their shopping and get the hell out. Mm-hmm. And I just find it astonishing that this is still not known. We've had a Black History Month for quite a few years, but there's another related book that you probably have looked at too, is Bitter Waters Run Deep, which is about the racial cleansing of various counties around the country. It's astonishing that this is just, I mean, the attitudes that underlie that are maybe ameliorated some, but there's still quite a bit of this racism.
Yep.
And to say that we're in a post-racial... Anyway, I just wanted you to react to some of that, and I appreciate your efforts. Thanks all. Both.
Thank you, caller.
Yeah, well, I recommend both books, Deep Waters and Sundown Towns. Of course, African Americans have known about... I've heard about these towns since I was a kid. It's part of the oral tradition. but you know, it's, now it's been documented. As a matter of fact, I wrote a song for Cassandra Wilson about you know, one of the sundown towns, and it's called "Vanished," and it's on a CD called "Sacred Ground." That was voted as one of the top CDs of 2007 by the Village Voice. I wrote two songs for her, and one is called "Banished," about this experience that African Americans had, where they had to flee thousands of acres. I think in Forsyth County, they had to leave behind 1,000 acres. And it was always some trumped-up charge, some incident that ignited the whole thing, and that was inflamed by the press. I mean, you know, some of the biggest riots in American history resulted from yellow press. Charles Chestnut, the first great African-American writer, who was so white that he could mingle with all different kinds of groups. He worked on Wall Street for Dow Jones. But he wrote two books, The Marrow of Tradition, two novels, among his work, two novels, The Marrow of Tradition and The Colonel's Dream. And in both books, the villains are newspaper men. One incites a lynching, and the other a race riot. He was talking about the race riot in Wilmington, North Carolina, where the African-American government was removed by force. And, you know, these kind of massacres happened throughout the South where, you know, when Gloria Steinem says, well, you know, black men have had the vote 50 years before women, well, they had a hard time exercising the vote. I mean, a lot of them were lynched. So So along with the corporate media, you got the school curriculum that's responsible for, I think, a lot of the problems that we're having in the United States. And James Loewen is a crusader. I recommend his books, Lies That My Teacher Told Me, Sundown Towns. And he did another book about all these fake monuments, you know, for Confederate monuments that had nothing to do with reality or the facts that exist in the South. We just need a sort of like a relearning of the American experience. Now, when I went to school many, many years, maybe 100 years ago, the school curriculum was more devoted to European history than to American history. I mean, I think a lot of our public intellectuals today, as a matter of fact, one of them said that the War of the Roses was more important than the Civil War. Now, there's a period that happens after the Civil War that people ought to study, Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. And when the gentleman talked about rebellion, yes, there were rebellions, but most African Americans are like people all over the world. They use subversion. As a matter of fact, W. Du Bois, in his great book, Black Reconstruction, said that it was because the slaves, so-called slaves, went on a general strike. This led to the South's defeat. And if you read some of the diaries of Confederate, you know, people who were witnesses to what happened in the Confederacy, you'll read that the blacks refused to work or they were turned up missing. So this led to the collapse of the South. But these are important things that we don't know about because now I'm just learning about my hometown. I grew up in Buffalo, New York. And there again, the school curriculum was more devoted to you know, European history, London, history of London and Paris. There's nothing about my town. And now I find that some of the great architects have built buildings and designed buildings in Buffalo that exist to this day downtown. That Buffalo, I didn't learn until I left Buffalo that it was a big place where, for the Underground Railroad. It was the last stop before Canada. Mm-hmm. All these things. So, you know, we should be devoted to local history, to American history, and then maybe we avoid some of these problems.
You know, you alluded to or just mentioned Gloria Steinem, and some of your most controversial writing has been dealing with the tension or conflicts at times between feminism, especially white feminists, and civil rights movement, African-American politics, and it's emerged in this whole Clinton-Obama contest especially. What is your critique in that area? For how would you put it?
My comments are very mild in comparison to what the black feminists say about white feminists. I mean, you know, Amy Holmes is one of the few African Americans that cable feels comfortable with. And even she resented the fact that she's a Republican. I think she's a Republican speechwriter or something.
Yeah, I think she's on the Bill Maher show, too.
Yeah, she's all over. She's on MSNBC, CNN. She's just all-purpose commentator for the African-American experience when I think the Republican support among African-Americans is about 2% or something like that, last I read. But anyway, even she resented the fact that his Hillary Clinton, who's a white woman, they never mentioned that they can call Obama a black man, but they can't call her a white woman, who's a wife of a former president, first lady, saying that she's victimized. I mean, you know, that just drives African-American women and even Latinos, scholars and intellectuals, crazy when, you know, they feel that white middle-class women have sort of embezzled their oppression, using it as their own, and ignoring them. I mean, if you read books like The Feminist Project or The Trouble Between Us, you find African-American women and Latinas complaining, and even Chinese-American feminists complaining that the white feminist movement has excluded them, accusing them of racism. So my little, you know, I got into trouble. I was left a literary roadkill in this country because I criticized The Color Purple. I mean, before that I'd ridiculed different groups and satirized different groups. Boy, they didn't have the power of these feminists, I'll tell you that. They boycotted me and everything. I mean, what I said was mild in comparison to what Toni Morrison said about the book in an interview with Cecil Brown at the University of Massachusetts Review, or what Bell Hooks and a number of black feminists said, but they don't care what black feminists say. I mean, the white feminists completely ignore what their attitudes and their... I mean, here's Gloria Steinem, using a hypothetical black woman, and if you read Jill Nelson, I quote her in one of my pieces in Counterpunch. She just said, she just resented the fact. Here's Gloria Steinem saying if Obama were a black woman, he would not get as far as he's gotten, which sort of echoed what Geraldine Ferraro said later. Mm-hmm. I think Gloria Steinem set the tone for that kind of talking point. Well, you know, she had an opportunity to support a black woman candidate, Shirley Chisholm. She supported Shirley Chisholm, but then she abandoned Shirley Chisholm for the man, Walter Mondale, during that Democratic convention. So we just feel that a lot of people just feel first of all, that this white feminist movement has singled out black men to practice their feminism on. I mean, sort of off-Broadway. We wish they'd go on Broadway. I mean, experimenting on us.
Well, you know, even...
Letting these other guys go, you know?
Yeah. In one of your other writings I was looking at recently, I mean, you made a more broad statement. The entire U.S. left basically has decayed, and one of the reasons was that it sort of bought into the whole culture of demonizing black men.
Oh, they demonized white men, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in her article, she said that white men are voting for Obama because they feel that a black man is a super masculine, or something like that. And my reply was that at the time, four of the heavyweight champions were white. I mean, in the last 2 years, two of the most valuable players in NBA have been white. So, you know, this is certainly pop psychology, and it's sort of like ridicules or undermines or diminishes or what downplays the motives that white men have for voting for Obama. So this is I think that, you know, I know this sounds like a cliche. I think Gloria Steinem and people like that have a rage for all men, not just us, but because, you know, they get a lot of their finances from white men, we get it worse. But they probably feel the same thing secretly about them. Matter of fact, when Ms. Magazine called me the worst misogynist in the United States, they called me, at one time Ms. was edited by Robin Morgan.
That wasn't in your biography I saw on the website.
Yeah, well, I mean, she did. They called me, I was the worst misogynist in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It was edited by Robin Morgan. Now, here's Robin Morgan. This is why I think that the white feminist movement has infected the left with some daffy thinking. She thought that Valerie Solanas' sentence for shooting Andy Warhol was too severe. I think it was 2 years. This woman went over to Andy Warhol's factory and tried to kill every guy in sight. You know what I mean? So she said... So anyway, I wrote her recently asking her, did she, after, you know, the invasion of Iraq, where many of her brown sisters were murdered and massacred and everything, did she still believe that was the worst misogynist in the United States? And I think she still holds that opinion.
Well, You are our guest, Ishmael Reed, today on Media Matters. It's an honor to have you. We have phone lines open at 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines to line one. Urbana, you're on the air with Ishmael Reed.
Hello? Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, even if we could, like, suddenly all get along, black men will have, proportionately will have, criminal records, and vast portions of the economy depend on a prison population. I can't begin to think of how you start to turn something like that around.
Right. Well, I mean, the caller raises a good point, and it's rare to find somebody that informed.
Yeah, that's not one of the issues that you're seeing as you do monitor the news media, is it?
Certainly not. Because the prison industrial complex is what Angela Davis calls it, where they harvest all these young kids and everything and put them in prison in order to fuel the economies of these rural areas. For example, I was in Pennsylvania going toward Ottawa, and the professor was driving. He said that the people who were the former economy of this rural area was dairy farming. And that went under. And so now, you know, they make their money through prisons. That happens in California, too. So this dates back to what Charles Chestnut, I recommended everybody read The Colonel's Dream. Charles Chestnut is just beginning to be canonized, part of the literary canon. And he talks about how after slavery, the emancipation, they use vagrancy laws to get cheap labor. So, you know, even a lovable uncle, one of the lovable uncles in the book, gets arrested on vagrancy charges and is hired out to some guy to use them as free labor. I mean, Charles Chestnut's point was that slavery continued under different forms, under labor contracts and vagrancy laws. Well, the kind of thing happens nowadays. Not to say that every African-American male in a prison is innocent, but I would say probably one-third are there on basis of gratuitous or capricious charges. And I see, you know, even the American government or the Bush administration has pointed out in a study that the racial profiling exists and that traffic stops involving Hispanics and blacks are more likely to lead to imprisonment than traffic stops, aimed at white drivers. So, I mean, the caller has a good point. It's a hidden issue. I don't expect Obama to talk about it. Because he probably believes that there's such a thing as criminality among vast examples of criminality among black population. 70% of the people who commit crimes in this country are white, both in the urban and rural areas. And I think from the time of the arrest to imprisonment, there must be some kind of Bermuda Triangle in the justice system. You know what I mean? Where these people who arrested vanish or something. So, yeah, that's a very good point.
Ishmael Reed, our guest today on Media Matters. Let me, if I can, turn it a little bit to just ask you a few questions based on your whole career and what you're doing now. Who are the writers and public intellectuals in the United States today that you admire, that you read, that you learn from?
Well, you know, I think we'd become a more enlightened population if MSNBC cable shows not only had African-American guests with whom they agree, but those who would challenge them. For example, I'm thinking about Martin Kilson, Professor Martin Kilson at Harvard University, who challenges this post-race stuff, and Ron Walters, who teaches at the University of Maryland, and Cecil Brown, who's a novelist, and Al Young, who's the Poet Laureate of California. You rarely hear their voices in the media, but they would certainly challenge the viewers of the cable, which is unlike the people they bring on now. For example, they brought on this guy named Reverend Rivers to denounce Obama and Reverend Wright without checking his background. I mean, you're talking about Reverend Moon. You had people from the Washington Times on. I guess you saw that where they were criticizing Reverend Wright. Well, Reverend Moon made some terrible anti-American remarks. The guy that owns the Washington Times said the United States was satanic and all that stuff. So I think There are a lot of public intellectuals. I mean, there are hundreds of them, African Americans, and who are authorities and who can contribute something to the discussion. I think Michael Dyson is okay sometimes. Michael Dyson is very good.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the corporate media just settles on a few voices. For example, the New York Times, for example, has two or three African-American intellectuals commenting about race, and they live in Cambridge. I mean, when I taught at Harvard, I didn't see very many African-Americans on the street. So when here we are confronted in Oakland with this crime in my block and other neighborhoods, and when the New York Times want to get somebody to talk about it, they got a Harvard professor to tell us what's happening here, you know, in the ghetto.
Yeah, and, you know, talking about academia, you taught at Berkeley for decades, and you've been a guest professor at Harvard and Yale, all sorts of elite institutions around the country. Mm-hmm. Academia is often held up to the layperson and even to academics' own self-impression as this den of open-mindedness and commitment to human rights and fundamental democratic values. Is that what your interpretation is of academia based on your experience?
I think the universities I've taught at are very Eurocentric. It always amazes me when the right wing says that, you know, they're hotbeds of radicalism, and I mean, even the most radical professors, you talk to still believe that, you know, they still have a curriculum that's largely devoted to European studies. So I think it's a myth that there's such a thing as a radical university. I mean, all one has to do is to dispel this myth is to pick up the catalogs of maybe four or five universities at random, and you'll find that the curriculum is mostly Eurocentric. They have a few tokens. For example, if you go to a lit class or an English department, you might find Zerlina Hurston on there or Alice Walker, but beyond that, very little.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. We have one caller who's been waiting patiently. Line one, Urbana, you are on the air with Ishmael Reed.
Hello. I have a question relating to the earlier caller who mentioned the book Sundown Towns.
Mm-hmm.
An incident that occurred here recently, in fact, the trial came up Friday. A young African-American, he's 18, no criminal record, never been arrested, had been participating in a basketball program in a gymnasium in a park. The park closed at dusk, but obviously the gymnasium was open until 11, and people who were participating had to have the right to walk out through the park. The police stopped him, and this was in Champaign, and accused him of trespassing, that he was in the park after dusk. And I think a few words may have been exchanged, but it remained certainly nonviolent. But the police grabbed him, threw him against the nearby wall, searched him, ultimately threw him on the ground and handcuffed him. And even though it became apparent that there was no trespassing because the gymnasium was open and he had been participating there, they proceeded to prosecute him for resisting arrest. There seems to have been minimal resistance. And an all-white, in fact, an all-white rural jury found him guilty. Would you comment on how typical this sort of thing is?
Well, I think it's very typical. I think that's one of the reasons that contributed to the large incarceration of African Americans. I mean, look at the drug laws. I mean, you know, the media myth is that blacks do powder cocaine and whites do crack. Whites do crack too. They just don't get sentenced for it or convicted for possessing crack cocaine. So I think, yeah, this is just another example of racism in the criminal justice system. Now, out here where I live, we meet with the police every month. I go down the street here at this school, and the police show up, and we talk to them about our problems, and, you know, we've worked with them to solve some problems. So I think African-Americans need police protection. We just don't want Mark Furman. And there must be some kind of way that the police force or the police academies have to find a way to weed out the Mark Furman so that we're not brutalized or beaten or shot without cause. They shot a kid up the street here shot him in the back. He was running away. So these are problems that have been here. And I think if you had a body count, if you looked at local newspapers that are published by black publishers, black newspapers, you'd be surprised at the number of incidents that occur under the circumstances that the caller described. So I think that, I would recommend that black history and Hispanic history be taught in the police academies. I mean, I'd be willing to go to a police academy and lecture for free.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
If it would do any good, just as we have, professors and scholars and writers going into prisons, you know, teaching inmates, we should have that for the police. And maybe, I mean, you're not going to get all of them because a lot of them, as the former police commissioner in New York said, come from authoritarian backgrounds. They're not going to change. But you can reach some of them. And, it's good for us every month to have this. And we're pretty candid with the police, you know. I mean, I told them the other night, I said, the reason you guys can't help us is because 85% of you live in the suburbs. I mean, you spend all your time commuting. You know? We like to have the police live in our neighborhoods, live in the city, so they don't understand our problems. But, this is changing. I mean, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you had police selected on the basis of whom they knew or the ethnic group they belonged to. But now you have a more diversified police force in many cities.
Ishmael,
I would like to see more education.
Ishmael Reed, we've only got a little over a minute left. And if I can close the show today, I'd like to step back. And you know, you are someone who's been active now for 5 decades in American intellectual and political and social life, cultural life. You know, if you look at America today compared to the America you came of age in, what would you say is, you know, the changes that have been most impressed you or the changes that most concern you about this country?
Well, I think immigration has certainly changed the demographics of the country. I mean, I'm reading that in 2050 there will be most of the population will be Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hispanics, so-called Hispanics, and many of them have black ancestry, incidentally, although many some deny it, are reproducing faster than both black and white populations. So we're looking toward a Creole nation. That's what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But things have changed. I mean, I was a kid in Tennessee. I remember the white and colored signs. I remember there are incidents I'll never forget. I mean, maybe that's what separates me from the post-racist generation. When I was, you know, a kid like a kid on Lookout Mountain in Tennessee, I couldn't drink out of a water fountain. My mother, who was well-dressed, a beautiful woman, you know, educated, you know, yanked me from this fountain. I never understood what that was all about until later, that, you know, that I was considered subhuman or inferior or whatever. So, I mean, there are these scars, maybe, I'm 70 years old, I'm part of my generation that will never heal, but I've seen progress, certainly. I've seen this generation that Obama represents, that's progress. I mean, 30 years ago, many of us didn't have degrees, and now these kids have gone to private schools, and they've got, but I think they're going to be challenged. Ultimately, they might be challenged more than we were challenged.
You know, on that note, I'm afraid I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to get me out of the studio.
One more thing. You know, I hope everybody go out and get our album. For All We Know, Ishmael Reed Quintet, Amazon.com, CDBaby.com.
Thank you so much, Ishmael Reed, for joining us today. My name's Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters. I'll be back at noon next week for a special 2-hour edition. I'll see you then, and I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, for his wonderful work. Have a great week, everyone.